Honorable Court is again in session. Be seated, please. Case number 19-1594 et al. Charles Gresham et al. Versus Alex Michael Azar, second, Secretary, United States Department of Health and Human Services, in his official capacity et al. Appellant, State of Arkansas. Case number 19-1595 et al. Ronnie Maurice Stewart et al. Versus Alex Michael Azar, second, in his official capacity as Secretary of the United States Department of Health and Human Services et al. Appellants. Commonwealth of Kentucky ex rel. Matthew G. Bevin, Governor. Ms. Klein for the federal appellants. Mr. Geshegorn for the appellees.
Morning, Ms. Klein.
Morning. May it please the court. Elisa Klein for the federal government. A number of states that have chosen to provide substantial amounts of optional Medicaid coverage are testing various ways to try to make their Medicaid programs more cost effective. And the mechanism that has been the principal focus of these cases tests out work-oriented requirements that are modeled on those in the existing federal TANF and SNAP food assistance programs in order to see if the application of those requirements helps to transition Medicaid recipients from the Medicaid program into commercial coverage. And it's particularly important to emphasize that that commercial coverage would not be limited to employer-based insurance, but also would include the heavily subsidized exchange insurance.
Is that what they're trying to test, whether it transitions people to commercial coverage? Because I thought that was sort of a little not the central objective, that the central premise was that whether you earn money or get a better job that comes with coverage, that doing the work is healthy, that doing volunteer work, that doing training, that doing even a job that carries no commercial insurance is correlated with health, and therefore there isn't data in the record about people getting a leg up into a market through a work requirement and eventually how many of them get commercial insurance. I didn't see that as part of the record.
Well, let me unpack the various questions. So both are true. It is unquestionably true that part of the hypotheses being tested are for existing Medicaid recipients, you know, these are primarily expansion adults, while in the Medicaid program, whether you will see improved health in part as a result of these work-oriented requirements and also other aspects of these demonstrations that are meant to increase preventive health services uptake, which is very low among the expansion population. So that is definitely a piece of it, but in the record, for example, the Kentucky application in July 2017, Kentucky made various modifications, and in the public notice that it put out to describe the objectives of the project, it included transitioning adults who can graduate from Medicaid into the exchanges and other commercial coverage.
I have only one question for each side, and it's one that I would have thought should be simple, and maybe I'm overlooking something. But that is, in case of each of these states, the requirements that have been placed on the new recipients are in a program that has two populations. The ones who are already covered, that is, so they're already receiving some Medicaid, the ones who are coming in under the modified plan that the department is accepting from these individual states. The question I have is, do these restrictions that are placed in the accepted exploratory programs apply to both populations, that is to say, the existing recipients or only and the new recipients, or only to the new recipients?
So the requirements for both Kentucky and Arkansas apply to the expansion population, but whether or not they were being covered before these demonstrations were approved. And in Kentucky also to a sliver. So it's not just people who for the first time are, if I'm answering the court's question?
I falsely claim that I have only one question, but that leads me to another one. Given their application to perhaps some of the existing population, is the government then correct that the new programs do not expand the coverage of the ACA program, the Medicaid program?
I'm not sure I'm understanding it. Perhaps I can step back.
The position that seems to be taken by the government, I'm not nearly as simple as I thought it would be.
Okay.
The position that seems to be taken by the government is this is not furthering the objectives of the Act.
Oh, by plaintiffs.
Because it does not expand the covered population. If the new accepted programs do increase the population that is potentially covered, although not as much as they would increase it if the requirements were not there, does it not then further the objectives of the statute by increasing the covered population, even though it didn't increase as much as it could have?
I don't believe the factual premise is a correct description. Both states, Kentucky and Arkansas, are ACA expansion states. So they elected, though they didn't have to amend their state plans in order to provide coverage to these newly eligible adults.
Yeah.
And that happened before. Arkansas did it in connection with a demonstration, but it amended its state plan.
It amended its state plan.
It did. And just to be clear, under NFIB, states that choose to do that have the prerogative to change their mind. And you know that was important and explicitly an assurance that HHS gave back in 2012 when states were contemplating
these. I'm not sure I'm getting at what I'm trying to get at.
Okay.
The question I've got is, the programs that the government is challenging, I mean that the government is being challenged on today, that the district court ruled were invalid, do those programs actually result in an increase in the potentially covered population in that state or not?
In the long term, the answer is hopefully yes. In the near term, if I'm understanding the question, that's not our argument. Because
I know it's the government's argument.
Well, we are the government.
Whoa.
Okay.
Excuse me just a minute. The government's argument seems, I'm sorry, the complainant's argument, I'll get my cases backwards.
Okay.
The complainant's argument seems to be that the new parts of the program accepted by the government do not further the objectives of the statute because these work requirements cause a decrease rather than an increase in the people who are eligible. Now, if it's not the case that that work such a decrease, if the total is going to be greater than it was before, is not the objection by the complaining parties wrong?
It's not our argument because I don't think the court's factual premise is accurate, if I'm understanding it. What the plaintiffs would like is for the expansion population to be covered, you know, under the ACA with the benchmark plan with no additional conditions on eligibility.
Right.
And that's what was happening before these demonstrations were approved.
Mm-hmm.
The reason that we've given, and that of course the secretary has given, that these particular measures are likely to promote the coverage, expand coverage in the long term, is because Medicaid is a dynamic program in which an enormous amount of spending is optional. And so if states can find ways to make their programs more cost effective, and that can be either by helping people who can graduate onto the exchanges do so, or to go back to Judge Pillard's question, by making it more cost effective while the participants are in the Medicaid program, that is what frees up scarce resources that can then be used for other people in need.
And what is the would like your help in pinning down, what is the hypothesis or the hypotheses that are being tested here? One of them, I gather, is whether the application of these requirements is going to transition people to commercial coverage.
Yes, sir.
Another is whether the people who remain covered are going to have improved health as a result of work-oriented activities.
Yes, but not exclusively. So there are 100 pages of special terms and conditions attached to the Kentucky approval letter.
I know
and the
that.
Back end has, you know, evaluation and monitoring, and the application has a series of hypotheses, but I just don't want to forget about the premiums and the way, the elimination of retroactive eligibility and the Kentucky My Rewards program, and these were parts of a broader program, many of which are meant to encourage increase in preventive services.
Including, for example, the anti-retroactivity provision,
yes,
is, you know, sign up early rather than wait till you get sick. That is gonna, and when there's a lot of sort of vague language in the briefing and in the record about enhanced engagement with your healthcare, that's talking about those non-retroactivity provisions, right? It's not,
yes,
that you're gonna, as having a work requirement is gonna make you more engaged with your healthcare.
No, the court is correct. That type of, it sounds like lingo, but this is the same theory that the that HHS back in 2015 approved for the Indiana demonstration, comparable, you know, to some extent identical measures like premiums, elimination of retroactive eligibility. The
those
idea
have not been sustained by a court, have they?
Well, that is the new Indiana lawsuit that was just mm-hmm. filed, and I mean, if the court looks, it's the point I don't want lost, if the court looks at that complaint starting around paragraph 70, I mean, these were, after extended negotiations with Indiana, this was the agreement that was reached that allowed Indiana chose to do the expansion because it was being also allowed to test these requirements.
Now, I gather, though, that the government is not defending in this court that it is an serves the interests of Medicaid to increase in any degree the number of covered persons, and therefore the state's threat that unless this is approved, they will give up expansion, gives them license basically to offer expansion on any grounds whatsoever. You're not defending on that.
No, and to be clear, that is not what the Secretary said. And just to look at the facts, Arkansas, the demonstration applies only to the expansion, and it proposed to drop the eligibility from 133% of federal poverty level to 100%, and HHS said no. So by no means are we suggesting it's a free-for-all just because the expansion was made optional by NFIB.
But you plainly would not take the position that blackmail is a reason for upholding.
Well, to be clear, I mean, the federal government is not going to be easily forced to approve projects it doesn't want to approve. Here, these are, you know, the Kentucky application was submitted in August 2016. These were years of back and forth and negotiations in which all sorts of additional qualifications were required of Kentucky before CMS gave that ultimate approval, even the first approval, and particularly meant to align with the TANF and SNAP programs. So the requirement that anyone exempted under TANF also has to be exempted from these work-oriented requirements, that was something that was added to the Kentucky demonstration at a fairly late stage, even after those July 2017 amendments.
Can you tell me why, forgetting your position on reviewability, just assume I don't buy
it. Yes, I'll assume.
All right.
Yes.
Why Judge Boasberg's very thorough and careful analysis in very usual administrative law terms is not eminently correct, principally based on the Secretary's failure to consider the effects on coverage is alone enough. I mean, and you're citing objectives, which he says, I think forcefully, are not objectives of the statute.
So I think we first very much disagree with that premise. That help, if I may explain, let's start with helping people who are in the adult expansion population transition to the exchanges. You might wonder, you know, why is the federal government here supporting that? Because that means instead of the joint federal-state financing of their health care, you've got massive federally funded subsidies for their health care.
No, wait. He is saying, he's looking at data. He's saying you're not addressing the effects of the programs on coverage. The real effects, not hypothetical effects, the real effects.
Well,
and I gather you point to a sentence where the Secretary says health benefits outweigh coverage losses. And I is that the only place
in
the record where the secretary addresses that question?
No.
Well, I understand my question. I mean, he's making it's a very long, thoughtful, thorough opinion. Bottom line, he's saying you're not addressing something that's critical in this case, the effects on coverage, and the effects on coverage are not hypothetical.
So he is assuming that any projected reduction in coverage means bad coverage loss, as in people going without coverage.
That's actually what I'm trying to find out, the question that I didn't make very clear. Excuse me, Judge Edwards.
Go ahead.
So I just want to emphasize, from the start, and you know, in the Kentucky application, is the objective of helping people get, you know, the education they need, the job training skills. You know, it could be a GED, volunteer opportunities.
Is there anything in the statute that makes that objective of this statute? I mean, those are all laudable goals, but the question we have here is whether the acceptance furthers the goals of the statute. And
okay, I see. The reason it furthers the goal is because, as this court in the Farmer versus Thompson opinion recognized, and Supreme Court in Farmer versus Walsh, and more generally in Dublino recognized, if you can conserve what are finite state Medicaid resources by having people who don't need to get Medicaid get their coverage in a different way, that is promotes the objectives of the Medicaid program. And part of the reason it does so, you have to understand that about 50% of state Medicaid spending is optional populations.
Let's assume that's arguably correct to some extent. What Judge Boasberg said is there's data, there's real information, briefs on the other side pointed out, where there are adverse effects on the population covered where people are dropping out. People are going to lose coverage because of the pilot. They're going to lose coverage, and what he is saying, importantly, is you haven't addressed that.
Okay, if the court is
let me make it very clear, this is what Judge Santello is just saying, and you can't point to other objectives that are not statutory objectives and say, well, we've addressed them. And he, I think, very convincingly says, no, that's not an answer. The principal objective is coverage. The data shows people are leaving because of the pilot program, and you haven't explained it, you haven't addressed it, you haven't accounted for it.
Okay, if the court is referring to the Arkansas statistics, there were 17,000 people who temporarily lost coverage at the rollout of the Arkansas project. And this is important, I want to differentiate between, and that, like, I am in no way diminishing the significance of that, but the point of having state demonstrations is so that you identify that type of rollout issue at the local level where it can be fixed easily. And if the court remembers the rollout of Medicare Part D in 2006, when you were supposed to have 6 million elderly Medicaid recipients transitioned to Medicare Part D, that was a fiasco, and it was not addressed that easily, and 20 states had to enact emergency legislation. So rollout problems are real, and they are, you know, a distinct category, and that is part of the reason for this demonstration authority.
Isn't one of the requirements of an application that you have a demonstration evaluation instrument and details in place, and that you actually do estimate in a concrete way whether there will be losses in coverage? And I didn't see those pieces in the record.
Well, in Kentucky, To the extent the regulations, this is post-ACA, there are regulations that require certain information in
the
application.
We're talking about this does not apply to 431.
It does not apply to Arkansas because that was an amendment to an existing demonstration. Okay. In Kentucky, because it was a new demonstration, they did apply. And that is the budget neutrality worksheet that Judge Boasberg referenced in the opinion. But he misunderstood what it was saying, and he also overlooked changes that were made after the time of that projection. So he
misunderstood what it was saying in terms of the person hours rather than individuals or person months?
More important, he assumed that any reduction in coverage meant people going without Medicaid, as opposed to what I'm going to read from. This is 5427 of the Kentucky Administrative Record, and this is the public notice that Kentucky put out at the simultaneous with that budget neutrality worksheet, and says in later demonstration years, more participants are expected to transition to commercial coverage. As distinct from, like, you can imagine in a program in which you can get a GED, that counts, that does not immediately transition you to commercial coverage. It might take another year of job skills training and another year of volunteer experience. These are, over time, hypotheses. Of course, there are no data because it hasn't been implemented yet, but they're hypotheses about what could happen if the TANF and SNAP type requirements are tested on populations that are materially comparable to the people who are already subject to them under TANF and SNAP.
So you're pointing to the fiscal soundness of the program as an objective, and saying that getting more people into the private market serves the program's objective. Is that right?
Yes, because fiscal soundness, we don't just mean is it on the verge of collapse. We mean the way the Supreme Court said in the Justice Stevens opinion in the Farmer versus Walsh, if you keep borderline populations out of Medicaid, that frees up resources that the state can then use.
But Walsh and Thompson did not involve taking people that are eligible under the federal terms and cutting back and making them ineligible.
Well, to be clear, these are not budget cuts. These are requirements, conditions, as under TANF and SNAP,
well,
that as
TANF
the
second. Those are statutory conditions there. That is not comparable to this at all, is it?
That is why this is a demonstration. The demonstration authority is being used in order to test requirements that, in Congress's judgment, are reasonable means to help people get the skills they need to transition to financial independence.
So when Congress had those goals in mind, it put those requirements in. But the goals of this statute that you're dealing with here, I'm not sure how you find that to be.
So I'm going back to the point, Judge Pillar.
Principal goal on the ACA, we're all putting our heads in the sand. If we don't see it, we're to provide greater coverage. That was what was the principal goal, just as Judge Boasberg said. And the other things that you're saying may be laudable goals, but to have them outweigh what is obviously the principal goal of the statute seems a bit strange.
No, let me make it concrete, because we're not saying they outweigh the principal goal of the statute. We're saying that these are means of accomplishing the principal goal of the statute. So again, think about the medically needy population for a moment. This is a massive, optional Medicaid population. It's what often allows elderly people in nursing homes to get Medicaid.
What did you call them?
Medically needy.
Medically needy.
Yes, this is in the Justice Stevens, the same opinion. He just explains, this is undisputed background, you've got the categorically needy, or also known as mandatory populations, and the medically needy, which was the big optional population and still is under Medicaid. So if you can come up with ways to shift people in the now optional ACA expansion population to the exchanges, that frees up more money that can be used.
But that's mixing apples and oranges,
right?
Isn't it? Because the medically needy were optional in the sense that you can strive to give them some coverage, whereas here it's optional in more of an on-off switch. I thought you weren't relying on the notion that because the state can altogether refuse,
right,
to cover the expansion population, that they can, you know, cover any fraction of that population. And
so
you buy that when you're in for the expansion, that is a mandatory population, then I'm not sure what your argument is.
Well, I actually am not sure the premise is correct about the medically needy, but even if it were, just again, this is going to what Justice Stevens pointed out in that Farmer versus Walsh opinion. Even with respect to mandatory services like inpatient hospital days, states have huge discretion in deciding how to reimburse. And so Justice Stevens cited an example of Tennessee as a cost-cutting measure, dropped the annual cap on inpatient hospital services from 20 days to 14 days. So it's a mandatory service, and he's just illustrating the breadth of a state's discretion. And so if you free up money, there is no question that if you free up state Medicaid money, that opens the possibility of providing coverage whether it's more services, services to more people. And that is was the same theory that animated the decision in Farmer versus Walsh, which is that you could impose certain types of burdens on existing Medicaid recipients in order to get drug rebates for non-Medicaid people in the hope that that means those people won't become Medicaid recipients.
But in, I guess in Walsh, to me, the thing that's more closely speaking to the issue in this case is that the court says that the fact that the program there, the prescription benefit program, provides benefits to needy people and curtails Medicaid costs would not provide a sufficient basis for upholding the program if it severely curtailed Medicaid recipients' access to prescription drugs. And here, by analogy, we have a proposal that the challengers are claiming does severely curtail Medicaid recipients' access, not just to one benefit, but to eligibility overall.
Okay.
So I think there's some...
Well, this is where, so I just want to make sure. So we're in agreement now on ends, that if these conditions can help to successfully transition people to the exchanges...
I'm not sure we are.
Well, let's... Well, the premise of the question is at least...
The premise of the question is even if that were the case,
okay,
there is a question whether... if it causes a dramatic reduction, has the secretary taken that into account?
Yes, and this is where, when the secretary keeps emphasizing that these conditions are designed to encourage compliance and that they are crafted, tailored, like the TANF and SNAP requirements, to apply to those people who can reasonably be expected to meet them. So this is, again, it's a hypothesis, it's an experiment, there's not gonna be evidence, but Congress's judgment, as reflected in those other statutes, is that for this population, it is reasonable to ask for 20 hours a week of the list of activities that is, you know, materially identical to the list we have here. It's actually more flexible under the Kentucky and Arkansas projects.
So if there were evidence that not watching television was, you know, made people healthier, could the secretary say, we're going to do a demonstration project, and if you watch television, you're off? You know, more than 6 hours a week.
So,
you know, the correlation with health, I'm just not understanding.
I want to turn back to that, but we just left objectives, and I just want to make sure that we have not left incomplete the point I was just making. I'm focusing right now not just on the healthier beneficiaries cost less for Medicaid programs, which I'm happy to address, but I want to talk about this very real, you know, you've got states here that have voluntarily chosen to participate in this expansion. You've got a number of states like Virginia in which the legislation authorizing the expansion was contingent on seeking a demonstration like this one. Montana also recently enacted legislation like that. And so I don't want to give any short shrift to the idea that these states are struggling to make sure that their expansions are on a sound financial footing. And a big part of that is if you've got the populations whom Congress has independently determined can be appropriately asked to do 20 hours a week of these activities in order, Congress's judgment, in order to help lift them out of the programs.
Where is your best evidence in the record that that would happen? The best evidence supporting the hypothesis that imposing a work requirement with monthly reporting that will, you know, that this stick, you know, it used to be a voluntary program in Arkansas, but not that there wasn't the level of uptake that they wanted. And so they said, well, we're gonna get better uptake and we're gonna, you know, get people into great jobs with market insurance. Where is the evidence that this kind of stick is even plausibly going to cause that effect?
It is the same social science evidence that has persuaded Congress not only to leave in place the TANF and SNAP requirements, although they've been criticized, but to strengthen them in the 2000s.
But Congress didn't put it here.
Right.
Your argument is proving against you, because if Congress put it where they thought it would work and didn't put it here, then Congress didn't think it would work here, did it? Or
no, at least Congress chose to allow states to impose these requirements across the board as a matter of federal law in TANF and SNAP. Congress itself imposed it for...
But not in the ACA.
Well, for Medicaid in 1996, Congress gave states authority to end the Medicaid benefits for TANF recipients who do not comply with the work-related requirements in that statute.
And stopped there.
Yes.
And
we're not suggesting that the secretary could, across the board, simply change Medicaid law and say there are now like the same TANF and SNAP requirements for everyone. This is an explicit exercise of the 1115 demonstration project authority that's intended to allow this type of innovation in the programs. And recall, we had 27 AFDC demonstrations.
You're not answering to what Judge Pillard asked, and which is what Judge Boasberg was resting his opinion on. You haven't addressed coverage in any way that judges, at least, can digest what you said and be satisfied this is reasoned decision making. That's what we're talking about. You're talking about hypotheses that are kind of up in the sky. Congress certainly didn't endorse them in the terms that you would like. And it's just that it's an administrative law process. You got to have reasoned decision making. You're looking to objectives that are not in the statute, and you're failing to address, as he said, the critical statutory objective, which is coverage. Bottom line, and Judge Pillar just asked you again, and you haven't been able to answer it.
I think we're maybe talking past each other, but Congress, in the separate programs, made a judgment that these requirements help to break the cycle of poverty and lift them out of the welfare program. In the Medicaid context, how does that work? If you're talking about a demonstration project, if you get a roughly full-time minimum wage job, you graduate out of the expansion population onto the exchanges where you are eligible for very high federal subsidies. That is a good thing. This is, of course, a hypothesis, because it's a demonstration and it hasn't been tested. So I want to address Your Honor's questions about health, but I know I have...
You can finish the answer.
So just on health, and again, this is addressed, these letters are the most comprehensive decision documents in the context of a demonstration project of all time. As Judge Friendly pointed out, there was no decision document in Aguayo, which is the seminal case on the 1115 authority. But on health...
But we don't have demonstration evaluation instruments in the record, do we? Or am I missing?
I don't know what's in the record, but again, this is longstanding. Because the special terms and conditions are not established until the approval stage, there is routinely another period of time before the evaluation, the protocols have to be submitted and approved by CMS. That's not a new...
I thought you, under the regulations that you point out apply to Kentucky, that there is a requirement of the demonstration evaluations, and the professor's brief, amicus brief, is very much focused on that. And I just wanted to know whether they're accurate when they say this was a case of experiment first and evaluate maybe.
So we address that. It's in a footnote because it wasn't an argument made by the plaintiffs. And we're just making the point that this is routine. This is not a new practice.
This being
until Kentucky has the special terms and conditions, which is what it gets as approval, it really can't design the entire evaluation protocol because that's supposed to be concordant with the terms and conditions. So that's not a new practice.
That's in a footnote.
Yes, because it was not raised by the plaintiffs. It was raised by an amicus.
Our colleague Edna Mitzer used to say, if you want us to read something, put it up where our eyes are.
Yeah, I actually try very hard not to use footnotes, but I was differentiating between arguments that were presented by the party and addressed by an amicus. And so again, on health, and this, just making a point, these requirements such as premiums, waivers of retroactive eligibility, like as in the demonstrations approved in the last administration, are designed to provide incentives for greater uptake of preventive health services, which are very, very low among the expansion adults. So notwithstanding all the money that's being spent, you are not seeing a dramatic improvement in the health. And just to close the loop, if the health of Medicaid recipients improves, that makes the Medicaid programs much more cost-effective because they're less costly to care for.
Just one last question. Are you relying, and to what extent, and I thought it was a main feature of the underlying documentation, but your approach today makes me question, are you relying on the notion that work or the work substitutes, in fact, make people healthier?
Yes, and to be clear, what the secretary said is correlate with improved health.
That.
Yes. Well, that the be careful not to overstate. This is a hypothesis, and the literature establishes correlation. It is very difficult in this area to prove causation.
Indeed.
Yeah. Okay. But again, to be clear, this is like it would be hard to prove that premiums cause greater investment in your health consumption, and that they cause increases in preventive services, though nonetheless this, and I realize the plaintiffs are challenging the last administration's approval of the Indiana plan now, but this is not a new concept, it's a familiar concept, and it's certainly a hypothesis that can be tested in the context of a demonstration.
And I think the question, the main gravamen of their case is at what expense in terms of coverage.
Yes.
Thank you. We'll give you some time for rebuttal.